Chata Adonai Eloheinu Melech Olam Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Hamim V'natan Lanu Et Torato Baruch Ata Adonai Noten HaTorah.
Many of you may not be aware that tonight is the beginning of a very special Jewish holiday that starts tonight, and that is Purim Katan, which is the small Purim. Because this is a leap year and we have an extra month of Adar, we have Adar 1 and Adar 2. The truth is Adar 1 is really the extra month and Adar 2 is the regular month. That's the month that we'll be celebrating Purim in, because Purim is supposed to come 4 weeks before Pesach. So if Purim were starting tonight and the Megillah reading was tonight or on Friday, etc., we would be 8 weeks out from Purim, 8 weeks out from Pesach, which is kind of makes me start to hyperventilate. Anyway, so, okay, 8 weeks, 4 weeks, so we have an extra month. So the extra month of Adar, the extra one is really the first one. The second one is the, quote, the real month. All sorts of interesting halachas about what you do for birthdays, yahrzeits, if someone was in the first Adar, the second Adar, there's a number of different customs around it. But that all being said, there is our understanding that the 14th of Adar in Adar 2, which will be next month, when we are celebrating Purim, that tomorrow, which is the 14th, it worked out really well this year because the English calendar days and the Hebrew dates are the same. So tomorrow when it's the 14th, and some people are having Valentine's Day, that's great. But the 14th of February is also the 14th of Adar this year. So the 14th of Adar is Purim Katan. It's the small Purim. So this is an interesting commentary that tells us how, first of all, as we know, it's the only Jewish holiday that only occurs sporadically. All the other Jewish holidays we have every single year. So Purim Katan is a special opportunity because we don't even have it all the time. Because if it's not a leap year, then we just go straight to Purim. After you hit Tu B'Shvat, 4 weeks after Tu B'Shvat, we'll be Purim. 4 weeks after Purim, we'll be Pesach. But this is a special opportunity. So our sages say that Purim Katan is exactly like the regular Purim. It's exactly like the regular Purim, with a few exceptions. There's no Megillah reading, there's no Shalach Manas, and there's no gifts to the poor. Other than that, it's exactly like Purim. So the question is, so what does that mean? What do you mean it's exactly like Purim? That kind of was my Purim, is all this. No costumes, no physical anything. The only thing that there is something of, and that's because of what we are left with. So if you take away all those things, what are we left with? We're left with the simcha of the happiness of Purim. So the Purim Katan is a day of only, it's a little bit like Simchas Torah and Sukkot. It's Ach Sameach. It's only about happiness. Wow. So it is a day to be happy, extra happy. The whole month of Adar is Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, that when Adar comes in, we increase joy. So it's the whole month is already elevated, and then Purim Katan gets the extra boost that that day is extra happy. So what do people do is they try to have something extra to eat to show that you're in a place of simcha on Purim Katan day, which is, so of course, it's about food, which is no diet tomorrow. So have something on Friday. Have some sort of... And nothing special, but something that is special to you. That just lunch. No, dinner's already Shabbos. Okay, so dinner is Shabbos. No, we don't put them together. And in fact, one has to be careful not to have anything too special on Friday during the day. Why? Because you need to have an appetite for your Shabbos dinner, which is its own kind of oneg, its own kind of joy. So we don't want to interfere with that. So something special, you can have it in the morning. You can have a special breakfast or a special treat, you know, a double latte, you know, whatever you want. Something that says, in the honor of being happy, I'm happy today. So that's Purim Katan, and it's considered the day where we are feasting at Hashem's table. That because normally we would have a Purim Seuda on Purim Day at our homes, but we're not having a Purim Seuda. People aren't inviting people over, so who are we eating with? It says we're eating with God. God invited us over for a special happy, happy meal, and to be happy because it's Adar and it's Purim Katan. It's also a time to think about the message of Purim, because the message of Purim is in the air, beginning with Adar and certainly with Purim Katan, because the question is, what are we happy about? And what we're happy about, because you say we could be happy about a lot of different things. So what's the difference of happiness here versus the happiness of Sukkot, the happiness of Simchas Torah, or any of our other times of happiness? So the happiness of Purim Katan is about the happiness that Purim brings us, which is the workings of God's hand behind the scenes, of being able to part the veils, to part the curtains and say, I see you, God, even though your name isn't in the Megillah. Your name is not appearing in the newspaper. Your name is not on the radio. Your name is not on the internet. But I see you working, and I see you working in my life, too. So it's a very good time to see God's hand in our life. And that's what makes us happy, is because we know that things are not chance. We know that things are not random, and that we can feel God's salvation, God's power, and God's strength and God's redemption through the ordinary everyday occurrences that get passed off as like, well, wasn't that lucky? Wasn't that fortunate? Because we know that the word Purim comes from the word lots. And lots, not the lot, but lots, casting lots, means about chance. It's like we name it chance because it's the antithesis of chance. It's not chance, that nothing is chance, that everything is orchestrated. So this is the day that we are happy about the fact that we know that it's orchestrated, and that we know that there is a conductor behind the scene, that it's not just random things going on in our life. So that is the holiday. So you don't have to make a menu. You don't have to invite anyone. It's not a synagogue holiday. You don't have to prepare anything. You can give tzedakah if you want, but it's not, we specifically don't do the kind of tzedakah that we do on Purim. This is about, I see God in the world. So in a way, you could say it's even more hidden than Purim is, because Purim at least comes out with a Megillah reading and costumes and a Seuda, a festive meal, and the Shalach Manas. Like, so we know through the physicality, we know that we're involved in the revealing of the idea that it's Purim. On Purim Katan, it's like our own hidden party. Our own hidden party to say that I know that God is not really hidden, that God is really revealed when I choose and care to see it. So that is the celebration of Purim Katan, which will be tomorrow. So enjoy the holiday. And then,
does it start tonight, though?
It starts tonight, okay. Yes. Tonight is Erev, because since all our holidays start in the evening.
Right. So could you do something tonight? Could you have a festive meal tonight?
You know, I don't know. It starts tonight at sundown, because all of our holidays. So you can talk to them tonight. The information I saw was about people doing something during the day, just to parallel, because the Purim Seuda on Purim is done during the day, because day is has to do with revelation, when things are revealed. So even the word Megillah, it comes from one of the roots of that is Gilui, which means to reveal. So it is when God's hand is revealed to us. Night is what we call when God's hand is hidden. So we associate, that's why we have a Megillah reading during the day on actual Purim, and why all of the mitzvahs of the day are done during the day, as opposed to during the night. So all of those things happen because we are revealing and showing like, ah, the light went on, the dawn has broken, and now I see. And so that idea is, night is, you can do whatever, but the not as relevant. So people don't have a Purim Seuda. And when it comes to Purim time, people do not have a Purim Seuda the night of the Megillah reading.
Right, because it's the day.
Because it's about day. We associate the concept of darkness with hiddenness, and the concept of daytime with revelation. So that's why all the mitzvahs are during the day, are during Purim day. So we just mirror that a little bit and have an echo of Purim that will be tomorrow. So maybe if you're making something special for Shabbos, you know, save a little side and snack on it or something while you're... That's my plan, I should tell you, actually. I'm sorry? It is seven times within 19 years, but it's not every 7 years. There is a formula, but it's not like the secular calendar of every 4 years there is a leap year. It's seven times within 19 years. You can Google it, and it'll give you the calendar. There's a schema for how that works. Just Google Hebrew calendar. Whatever. You'll find it. So there's lots of information. Okay. All right.
Thank you.
So, sure. So enjoy your Purim Katan. Hopefully it is a place of revelation and we can see the literally can see the light. So this week's Torah portion is Ki Tisa, and let's take a look at it. We want to talk about several different things. It is a full parsha, not that the other ones certainly are not, but this one is full parsha. And page 484, 485, and the parsha starts out with the part we're not going to talk about. It talks about the census that was taken of the Jewish people, and this part of the census is going to be repeated when we come to the Parshat Shekalim, when we talk about the giving of the half shekel, because it talks about that. So what we're going to talk about, though, are two highlights of the parsha. One is that at this point, when God is up on the mountain and up on Mount Sinai, and this is the parsha that features the sin of the golden calf, which always gets to us every year that it's something to really consider about how that could happen. But there's something that I want to talk about beforehand, which is that there's also a description, a command about keeping Shabbos. And it's a familiar song to many people. So if we turn to page 492 and 493, we will see, anyone can sing along, the song Vishamru, and people know this in various melodies, either Vishamru v'nei Yisrael et ha-shabbat la'asot et ha-shabbat l'dorotam v'rit olam. Okay, so you know, so many people are familiar with the song. It's also sung as Vishamru v'nei Yisrael et ha-shabbat. Okay, so it's a familiar song. It's part of our davening. A lot of people recite it before they make Kiddush on Shabbos morning as this recollection. So let's take a look at what this says, and we want to understand some unique aspects about Shabbos. It's something to keep in mind for ourselves as we focus on what we can do to enrich our own Shabbos experience. So let's just read verses 16 and 17. Susan, would you like to read that for us?
The children of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to make the Sabbath an eternal covenant for their generations. Between me and the children of Israel, it is a sign forever that in a six-day period, Hashem made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed.
Okay, great. We already had the commandment in Parsha Yitro to observe Shabbos. That was already given to us. So the question is, the Torah does not repeat things for no reason. That there's something that's going to be added to our understanding about Shabbos from this section here. Also something to keep in mind is the next line here, verse 18, it says, when he finished speaking to him, when God finished speaking to Moshe on Mount Sinai, he gave Moshe the two tablets of testimony, stone tablets inscribed by the finger of God. And the next thing, the people saw that Moshe had delayed in descending the mountain. So this is just right at the end of the 40 days and 40 nights that Moses was up on the mountain getting the tablets, getting the entire, you could say, the entire spiritual download of all of the instruction, interpretation, application of all the laws was given to Moshe so he would be able to teach the Jewish people. And it seems to be that this last paragraph about Shabbos is his God's final words. So I've had a whole 40-day thing, a whole 40-day time to instruct you and teach you, illuminate you, enlighten you. All of that has happened. And now, before you go down, let me just say this song, Vishamru V'nei Yisrael, and the Jewish people, the children of Israel, shall observe the Sabbath to make the Sabbath an eternal covenant. So first of all, the importance of Shabbos coming at the very end. My grand summary, before you go, this is what you need to know and to convey to the Jewish people. So just the significance of it alone. What's interesting in here is Vishamru V'nei Yisrael is to observe Shabbos. But the word shamor, or shomer, means something else more. It means to guard it. So we talk about guarding it in terms of guarding the sanctity of it on the Shabbos day, of preserving its holy nature by the things that we refrain from doing so that we don't violate its sanctity. But it also means to anticipate. So to anticipate, and the word is used in that way when Joseph has his dreams, and it says that Yaakov, that Jacob, that he guarded it, the word shamor. So it doesn't mean he guarded the information that Yosef had said about his dreams. It means that he anticipated it. It's like, I'm anticipating when this dream is going to come true. So the idea of anticipating Shabbos has a different idea, because it brings us then into the 6 days of the week. When we talk about I'm anticipating something with happiness and with joy, it's not just that I'm guarding it once it comes. That's already, the Torah already tells us to guard it. We already heard that idea, that we had to guard it. But what about the idea of our anticipation of it and what we do during the 6 days to prepare for it so that Shabbos ends up coming into our week and it's not just something like how I did last week where I was at 17 minutes and 59 seconds before lighting candles before candlelighting time, after candlelighting time. Okay, you have 18 minutes. That's why 17 minutes and 59 seconds is relevant. So it's like, so that's not called anticipating Shabbos. That's called, okay, I was guarding it once it got there. But anticipating it is a whole other thing. It's a whole other thing. It talks about all the preparations that we go into with the enthusiasm and excitement of what can I do to make my Shabbos special. Everybody is at a different level. Everybody is a different place on their journey, and what that looks like is going to be different for every person. But what can I do to make my Shabbos special that I'm thinking about during the week? We have a practical approach to it, which is some people say, invite your company for the next Shabbos on Sunday, make your menu on Monday, start shopping on Tuesday, cook something on Wednesday, and they have a whole thing where they're actually doing things to make Shabbos, and that's good because it helps to anchor thought in action, but part of it is generating the enthusiasm and the excitement for it. Susan?
It's kind of a mirror image of taking Shabbat into the next week.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So what Susan is talking about is we add on to Shabbos at the end so that sometimes people have different customs about, first of all, Havdalah is an hour after candle lighting was the next day. So if candle lighting is at 5, Havdalah is at 6 on Saturday night, so that we automatically add an hour to the day. So we're already making it a bigger, longer day. We make it into the longest day of the week by adding the hour, so we don't make Havdalah. Many people go even farther than that. They wait 72 minutes just to extend it more. And then if you have a Malava Malka, which is escorting the queen, you've officially ended Shabbos, but you're still carrying Shabbos out. So there's an idea of adding on to it on the front end as well. That's harder to do. So adding on the front end is people have the goal of bringing Shabbos in early, of not only not waiting till the very last second, but actually making it early, because arriving early for something means that you want to be there. Arriving when, you know, the gates are closing means that it doesn't really mean you couldn't be bothered, because I would hardly say that I couldn't be bothered. That was not really the reality. But it doesn't convey the same kind. You know, on a movie, if the groom is getting to the wedding, right as, you know, in a non-Jewish wedding, right as the organ is starting to play, you're like, does he really want to get... You might ask yourself the question of, like, how enthusiastic is he about this wedding? The bride's been there getting ready, her hair, the whole thing, the makeup, she's there. And the groom isn't there yet? I'm like, yes, the wedding was called for 6 o'clock, but arriving at 5:59 is not appropriate if it's your wedding. Okay? So, Shabbos is our wedding with God. Because what do we say when we have Kabbalat Shabbat? We refer to Shabbos and we say, Bowi Kala, come my bride. And Shabbos is the bride. And we think about this idea of Shabbos being all dressed up and the Jewish people are the groom. We all collectively, male and female, we're the grooms of Shabbos. And so what's required for the wedding to happen? In a Jewish wedding, the groom is the one who mikadeshes, who sanctifies. When the ring is given, it says, Hare at mikudeshet li. Behold, you are sanctified to me. in the liberal branches, there's some people add a little reciprocal thing, but the halakhic version of a marriage is the groom sanctifies the bride. She is there. Kala is a vessel. It's feminine. It's the recipient of the sanctification. If she's just there, dressed in her gown, and she walks down the aisle, and there's no groom to megadesh her, there is no wedding. There is no wedding. And what we're saying on Shabbos and the anticipation is we are the grooms. We are the ones who bring and create the Mikdash, the Kedusha, in Shabbos. So when it says here, Visharu B'nei Yisrael, hold on one second, Et HaShabbat, okay, so that's about the guarding and anticipation. La'asot Et HaShabbat, that means to make the Shabbos. It's like, what do you mean make it? Shabbos is every 7 days. I looked at my calendar, Shabbos, 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 Shabbos. It's coming, 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 coming. It's like the bride is coming. Whether or not there will be a wedding is up to us. So we are the Am Mikadashe Shvi'i. We are the nation that sanctifies the seventh day. We're the grooms who are come need to arrive under the chuppah to make the Shabbos. If we don't show up, there is no wedding. And then you have a bride standing there, the jilted bride. It's the saddest thing ever. I didn't have the jilted bride, but I at our wedding, which was at Rodef Shalom in 1978, I got dressed before they had like bridal rooms. I got dressed in the all-purpose room, which was really terrible in those days. It had a mirror that looked like a funhouse mirror, and those desks. We signed the ketubah like on a desk that had like one of those little, you know, rounded things, and I look so scary, and my aunt goes, don't worry, you look really beautiful. I'm like, I look terrible. So then everyone left me in there. We didn't know about having a shomer, of having somebody to stay with the bride and stay with the groom always. So I'm standing in this room. The whole rest of the wedding party goes out, and I'm standing there by myself. Well, all of a sudden, I had like the most illogical thought, which is, what if they forgot me? And like, maybe was I supposed to come out? And like, I didn't get my curtain, my call, like, you know, stage right or something. And I started like panicking, hyperventilating. I'm like, what am I doing in here? I'm like, I'm all by myself. Like, I'm a bride, all dressed and ready to go, and nobody came to get me for this wedding. So I went out, and they go, no, go back in. It's not time yet. But that feeling of the bride all dressed, ready to go, ready for the wedding, and is there going to be a wedding or not? So it was so sad, but it worked out. 36 years later, almost, God, thank God, worked out fine. But there was that feeling, and so that image came to mind of the bride all dressed for her wedding, because we're saying, Boi Kala, come, bride, come to the wedding. It's your wedding. And the question is, where's the groom? So we're the groom. So we are the ones that say, like, I'm excited that I'm having a wedding. I'm not coming to my wedding 1 minute before the time the wedding is called for. It doesn't convey a sense of excitement, of anticipation, and enthusiasm. And we also want the wedding to be beautiful. The wedding should be beautiful, and should be special, and it should be focused on the bride and groom. So this talks about, and this was came from a shir from Shira Smiles, and she is speaking to a religious audience. So I'll just say that. So when she's talking about that, she's talking still, even within that framework, of the challenge of making Shabbos special and beautiful and focused on Shabbos. That it's very hard. There's a phenomena in part of the Orthodox world that's called half Shabbos, where kids are texting on Shabbos, which is not, you don't do that on Shabbos. You don't use your phone on Shabbos. So people are texting on Shabbos, so they call it half Shabbos. They're not driving, they're not doing the other things, but they're doing that. And the question is, why are they doing that? It's like there's something missing in the Shabbos observance. Something is being lost, even people who are, quote, doing the steps of the feeling. It says, we've forgotten the la'asot et ha-shabbat, to make Shabbos joyful and happy, and to keep the wedding model in our minds. It says, Shabbos is, we have Friday night, which is the wedding, the candles that bring in Shabbos. The wedding starts, you have the chuppah. And then Shabbos day is considered like the what's called the yichud room. So after a wedding, the bride and groom go into a room, and a guard stands in front of that lest they be disturbed. Okay, that's one of the honors given out, is a guard at the chamber to make sure the bride and groom have intimate time together. They eat together, they talk together. In ancient times, it was really the time when the groom would take the bride back to his home or their home and would then have intimacy for the first time, and they would spend intimate time together. So think about a yichud room, the bride and groom, they haven't been with each other. They haven't, in some cases, seen each other for a week, which is interesting because it's a little bit like us since last Shabbos. I haven't seen you, my bride, for a week, and now we are reunited together in this yichud room. If she starts saying, oh, honey, you know what? I just need to make a quick call here. You know, I'm going to call somebody, and, oh, you know what? I got a little something on my dress during the ceremony. Let me just run a load of wash. I'll be just right back. It's like all of those interruptions seem absurd to us. We say, this is the time to bask in the relationship. Those other things, it's not, thou shalt not do this, thou shalt not do that. It's like, it doesn't fit. It doesn't fit with the experience of we're having intimate time because who are we having intimate time with? We're having intimate time with the creator of the universe. That's not so easy. What do you do exactly with the creator of the universe? So, hi God, it's me, Ellen. You know, it's Shabbos. Like what? So we need to create a structure that conveys that idea because it's not so easy to do. So if you have young children, the idea is to make things as sweet and pleasurable as possible because that's what creates the good feeling. So special Shabbos games that people have for their children or special stories, special food that they like to create the sense of oneg and that we're just big children. So we do the same thing. If there is a special game or something that is a Shabbos game or a special story, this is not the time to read things that are depressing, that have nothing to do with the relationship. This is the time to say, what is my relationship with myself and my relationship with my creator? It's like, why am I here? This whole week I did work. What was I doing? So I worked and I made money and I went to the store and I bought food and I did the laundry and I set the table 10 times, 15 times, 20 times. It's like, and now, what was that all for? Who am I? Who am I and what am I doing here? So those are the questions that we're trying to answer on Shabbos. And so we do that by reading things that are inspiring, about people who are inspiring. We read things, lessons from the Torah. There's so much written in English. There is so much out there you could read for the rest of your life. It's plenty, plenty to read, to talk about. I was very happy that someone that we invited to our home said they'd be happy to come as long as there would be words of Divrei Torah in addition to the food. I'm like, that's the spirit. I'm like, I should have said that when, we'll be having Divrei Torah and a Shabbos dinner. It's like, what's the most important thing here? The whole thing is important, to create the atmosphere. So the atmosphere is supposed to be one where we reflect on who we are in this world and why we did all the things that we did. And do we see God's hand in our unfolding of our purpose in this world in this past week? Bless you. Since each week, each Shabbos is a stopping point to stop and reflect on where did I arrive this week? What did I accomplish? And it doesn't have to be a physical accomplishment, a spiritual accomplishment. Was there a situation where I was provoked and I didn't lose my temper? I didn't answer back? Yes. I didn't speak Lashon Hara? I was considerate to somebody who was not so considerate of me. I gave an apology to somebody who it was hard for me to do. I did an action. I went to visit someone where it was uncomfortable for me if I'm scared by whatever their medical condition might be. There's something that's spiritual accomplishments. What did I achieve? And in my work, what did my work help me achieve also? Because the work is just a mechanism and a vehicle for our spiritual accomplishment. Anyway, we have interactions with people. We have honest business practices. We have a host of things of the Torah coming to life in our week. How did I do in that? And that's what I'm supposed to think about on Shabbos. If I don't take the time to do that, how in the world would I possibly be able to improve or make further steps the next week ahead? So the time is really set for reflection. That is what it means. Just as the bride and groom should be talking about their relationship when they're in Yichud. I'm so grateful that we're married. I love you so much. I can hardly, whatever it is that would be that talk, that's the talk. That's the talk of Shabbos. So having a wedding modality in our minds. So now all of us aren't in the situation where we have a home where that's going on. So some of us need to create that just ourselves. And there are a lot of things that a person can do if other people are not participating in the scenario. Because people sit and read. So one person's reading the newspaper, or they're reading their novel, or they're reading their whatever. No one says you have to read that. You can choose to read something else. You can choose to think something else. The truth is the thinking part, which is the hardest thing to do, is the most important part. The thought we put into what we're doing, and nobody can control your thoughts. That's, as far as we know, we have free control. So even if you're in a situation where you have to be involved in an activity that's not necessarily what you would choose to do for Shabbos, you can choose to, we all have parallel thoughts, even while you're talking to someone. People always have random thoughts. That's why people aren't really paying attention to what anybody's really saying, because we're always having our own thoughts. So have another thought. You're doing something, you can choose your thoughts, exactly what you want to think about. Read something. You know, there's like little bite-sized things to read, to have in mind, to ponder, to reflect on. You can do that really wherever you are and whatever you're doing. There is a, if you may remember, the story of manna that the Jewish people feasted on for 40 years, that we're told that it tasted like whatever they were thinking about. Okay? It tastes like whatever they were thinking about. So the question was asked, what if they weren't thinking anything? So it says, guess what it tasted like?
Like nothing.
Like nothing. So it says, like, no thought, no taste. So the thinking that goes into our spiritual goals and our spiritual efforts is the determining factor. And it's not just in that situation. It's even when we're involved directly in something spiritual. Somebody goes to the synagogue on Shabbos and they say, didn't do anything for me. It's like, guess why? It's like, what were your thoughts? What are our thoughts? We're the ones who are bringing the taste to it. Now you could say, well, the person singing was totally off key and I can't stand it because I have perfect pitch and so it drives me crazy. Or there was so much talking, I couldn't concentrate. So those are things to talk about. But if the service doesn't do anything for us, the responsibility lies with us. How did we prepare to go into that service? What did we do? What were our thoughts going into it? How did we prepare? La'asot et ha-Shabbat is we make the Shabbos. We create the flavor of the Shabbos. Yes, there are things that can help. A great sermon, a great speech, a great cantor, whatever, a quiet environment, the temperature just right. All those things do help, and they help a lot, and they can detract a lot. But the overall responsibility comes down to us. And that is what is really challenging for us, is to be able to do that. Did someone have a question or a thought?
I did.
Lynn, thank you.
It's human and it's natural in a relationship and Shabbos you did it before. You did it last week. You do it every week. And so that freshness that you're talking about is hard to conjure every parsha, when you've done it before.
Yes.
Is there any teachings about that preparation other than because sometimes, like, I do everything and it's just
flat.
Yep.
Yes. That is also true. So it's interesting. I was listening to, I have to say, honestly, I dozed off while he was speaking. Luckily, he was online, so he wasn't offended at all. So, it's about the difference between excitement and inspiration. Said excitement is what most of us are after. We want it to feel exciting. But that's different than inspiration. The word inspiration comes from the word breath. And it's like, how many of us find breathing exciting? Only when it's taken away. Okay, it's very hard to feel. We use the two terms as if they're synonymous, but they're not. So we can be inspired even when it's not exciting. In fact, there may be more opportunity for inspiration. That's what happens sometimes in marriages. Is people like what the 7-year itch or whatever it is? I think people now get it like at 6 months or something. I'm not sure what, because people are looking for excitement. They want something to feel exciting and to feel a rush. And so when something isn't, then we're hard-pressed to kind of stick with it. But if we think about the things that bring us the deepest joy and pleasure, it's really the things that we're able to carry on even through the times when it does feel flat, we should be looking for reinvigorating, but we can still be inspired even without it being exciting, knowing that we're doing what we're supposed to do, and that we're making something happen even if we're not feeling it. That's just then as an aside. Not that we should be settle for that, because the goal is make it inspiring. So the things that help that I find myself is I feel through my head. And so when I think new thoughts, or when I think about something and learn something new, it adds something for myself. Even making a new recipe, doing something in the physical surroundings to, you know, you're in development and programming, you have to do something sometimes to change it up a little bit to make it more interesting, just to give a little thing. I went to Hobby Lobby yesterday and got a little silver vase, this little thing to go in my bathroom. I'm so excited, you know? I keep going in there like, oh, that looks really good. It's just like a little something. And so part of the oneg is to do a little something that changes it up for you, or that makes it different from Shabbos, even if it's different from the rest of the week or different from previous Shabbos.
So is there anything in the Torah about new, like new each time, new? Because new is absolutely new, but then you look for new, then you're seeking new.
Right, then you're seeking novelty.
Right.
So the idea is really to see that the word, like when we have Rosh Hashanah, the word, it comes from the word shnayim, which means second, to repeat. But the word for repeat and change are the same. Shinui also means to change. So something to be repeated with change, the fact that you aren't the same as you were last week, makes it, by definition, different. The Torah, it's like, how many times do we have to read this Torah? Really, seriously, how many times? So part of it may be a misperception, that it seems like it's the same old, but it isn't, any more than you are the same old, and you're not. And maybe that would help in the preparation of, how am I different this Shabbos than I was last Shabbos? And maybe that goes back to what we said before. What did I learn? We would be so offended and insulted if somebody hadn't seen us for a while and they say, oh, she's the same as she always was. You'd be like, I am not. And they say, well, how are you different? Like, I don't know, but let me think. I know I am. So I am. So the fact that our physical cells are renewing themselves and we're actually not even the same person. So by definition, at the cellular level, we are different. Our thoughts are different. Our experience is different. We are in a different place. And so maybe it's just recognizing that and asking ourselves those questions of, how do I see that on one times, yes, it is a, like Mishnah Torah means to repeat the Torah, a repetition, but there's a shinui. There's been a change. So hopefully that helps. Helps me. I'm going to do that for myself. Okay.
Automatically, one of the things while you were talking, my mind did go.
Yes, I know.
I was still listening to you.
I'm
reminded of, you know, the number of times I've driven through Glenwood Canyon, over and over and over, going between here and Grand Junction, and every time I go through it, it's different.
It's different.
Because I'm either there at a different time of the day, or it's a different day of the year. And our Shabbos, we're going, you know, this Shabbos is different from the last Shabbos because it's 7 days later into the year.
Right.
And so there's something outside that's changed. It
right.
may not, you know, sometimes I want the, what do I do to inspire while I'm inside? But maybe it's just simply stepping outside to say,
it's different.
How does the world look different this week than it did last?
Very good. So we can use like all the cues. You can use all the cues around us of the physical world, the time, the calendar, the myself. In fact, the truth is, nothing is the same. That's really the truth. It's all different. It just has an illusion of sameness. It really is all different. Naomi.
Sometimes when things get, as you say, sometimes boring or whatever. What I do is I look for something in the parsha, about the parsha, to decorate the table.
Oh,
it's
that's
just a little something, you know. And I give my husband a clue, say, you know,
like a riddle.
What on the table is from the parsha?
Uh huh. Oh, that's a great idea. People have little kids. There's a whole book of ideas of desserts that are parsha, like, you know, parsha cakes, parsha stuff. Yeah. So my daughter-in-law does that kind of clever thing. I'm like,
I don't know, somewhere online, Google it, I don't know. So, yeah, but that's a great idea or something, or even, you know, you can even have like a Parsha quiz or something like that.
Fun.
Yeah, something that's fun. I mean, I know that for like our grandchildren, for example, they're like, ask me Parsha questions. And so they're, you know, when you have kids. The other thing that really helps is to invite company. Because by definition, as soon as you have somebody else at your table, the dynamic changes. And even your same old, because I know some people who make the exact same, their family likes the exact same menu every Shabbos. It's their Shabbos menu. And they would be horrified if they had something different. So what changes then? It's like the people, the time of year. It's really all changing. Beth Ann.
I think everybody sort of hit it, but I was doing the same. The word new in Yiddish is a question, new.
Oh, new,
you
huh?
Just try it.
New? What's new?
Try to figure out a question.
I like
it.
That's good. And that may be even a question to ask, depending on the people of, you know, to have a conversation at your Shabbos table with somebody, and even people who aren't religiously oriented, because sometimes that's hard too if you have people of various levels of interest and involvement, is say, how are you different today? What changed for you this week from last week? How are you different? And to have other people reflect on that. That's not necessarily a religious question. That's not like, you know, sometimes a question like, how did you see God in your life this week? You could get a lot of eye rolling, depending on your group. But if you say, you know, how did you change this week? What changed for you this week? That could get the thinking started. So this La'asot et HaShabbat, you see just even from our conversation, La'asot et HaShabbat, to make Shabbos, is something that we are the ones who are supposed to do it. And it says, La'asot et HaShabbat l'dorotam, to make it for your generations. It is a brit olam. It is an everlasting covenant. So it's not like, oh, I made Shabbos last week, and now I think I'll coast for a few weeks, and then we'll rev it up again next time, and then we'll kind of infuse it. It's like, la'asot et ha-shabbat l'dorotam brit olam. This is a making of Shabbos each time for your generations, and it'll become an everlasting covenant. And there's also the understanding that la'asot et ha-shabbat, to make Shabbos, that will give you Dorotam, that will give you your generations of the Jewish grandchildren that you would like to have, Berit Olam, with an everlasting covenant. So that is the goal, is to have this be a transition and transmission from one generation to the next. And it is this idea of it being a covenant. So that is the La'asot et HaShabbat L'dorotam Berit Olam. So hopefully we have an opportunity to do that at whatever level we're working at, to say, how can I make more of that? So now, after this wonderful conversation that God is having with Moshe about about Shabbos, then we have, just incomprehensibly, we have the Jewish people at the very same time involved with the sin of the golden calf. And it just seems mind-boggling. And I read something, I don't remember who wrote it, said, the juxtaposition makes it worse. Here Moshe is on Mount Sinai getting the Torah and lovingly making all the arrangements to teach the Jewish people, and at the same time, they are violating the most fundamental relationship that they have with God. Said it's kind of like a man who's having an affair while his wife is in the hospital giving birth to their child. Not that having the affair was a good thing anyway, but seriously, while she is involved with this, you are doing that? It's like, it's really outrageous. So the whole thing was outrageous, and the juxtaposition makes it worse. So we have to ask the question, how could the Jewish people have done that? What was the problem? What was the issue? And how could they have gone to idolatry? Idolatry seems like it is just a completely off-the-scale response of the Jewish people. So we really need to understand what idolatry is and how it functioned. So some people would like to think, oh, it's primitive people and the primitive Hebrews, and they were so close to idolatry in Egypt, so they just kind of reverted back to that. Bless you. So we have to really understand, is Judaism, the Torah, does not understand human beings ever having been primitive.
they may have been primitive in technology, and even so, not so much. They may have been primitive in technology, but there was no idea of being primitive in thinking, that the human being is an intelligent being. That's what God created, is an intelligent being. So people are smart. And in fact, we also know that the Greeks and the Romans, who we look to as a source for brilliant ideas about government and society and political organization, they were idol worshippers, and nobody ever calls them primitive. So this is not an aspect of primitivity. It is primitiveness. Primitivity is not a word. Primitiveness. It's like, so what is it? So this is an idea from Rabbi Nathan Weiss, who talks about that it's a misunderstanding of what's called the spiritual physics of the world. It says, how does the world work? It says, the world works is that God is the only source of anything that exists in the world. And at a level that we can't understand, that we can't name, that we can't comprehend, and it's called the Ein Sof, which means without end, we don't understand it. We don't understand it. We don't have a name for God at that level. We just say, beyond my comprehension is basically what we say. We relate to God in the names that we know. Adonai, the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh name, Elohim, Eloheinu. All of those different names are how we relate to God as God represents God's self to us in different dimensions of our life. But it's not the ultimate source of power. So here is Rabbi Nathan Weiss, who is a scientist, so he portrays things in a scientific way, which I happen to appreciate. So he talks about the physical world as it exists is really like a projection on a screen. It's really like a projection on a screen. It's more like if people who were Star Trek fans, the hologram deck. The holodeck, hologram deck, is that people, like, for activity or interest, they could go in, they could program a scenario, and they could enter reality, but it was really a hologram. And as soon as you flicked the switch, the whole thing disappeared. And the source of it was the source you couldn't see. It says, really, all of reality is a hologram, with one exception, us. Human beings are not a hologram because we are created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, which means that we are a source of reality and God is a source of reality. Everything in between is a projection, that God projects it into this world. And what the reality is going to look like is dependent on the spirit, God's spiritual force underlying it. So it gives the example of an onion, but I'm not sure an onion is the greatest example. But let's say this book here. If I put a cloth over this book, the cloth would assume the shape of the book. And the truth is I could put 50 layers of cloth, and that cloth is never going to be fully flat. Why not? Because at the core, there's a book under there that's creating the shape, right? So it was always going to look a bit, little bit like that. That's reality. Reality assumes the shape of what this innermost layer looks like, and the innermost layer is God's will. So if you want to change how something appears in its most external layer, it would be really kind of foolish to start playing around with the cloth covering the book, right? Because that's an external layer that is only taking its shape based on the book that's underneath. Where would you best direct your efforts? Move the book. Okay, if the book's not moved, that's never going to be flat no matter what. It says idolatry is addressing the external layer of reality and mistaking it for the internal source, which is why it's wrong. It's not wrong because God is like, I'm so offended, you're worshiping an idol instead of me. God is offended because a human being is designed to be in this world to function in true reality and not to operate in a false reality. We give people help if they're operating not in reality. Okay, we have psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists. We have all sorts of things that we do to help people so that they function in reality. Not functioning in reality is a big problem. For the Jewish people, it's the biggest of problems because they are the ones who have been entrusted with having the most intimate contact with the source, which is God, and operating within that framework. When the Jewish people went to a golden calf and went to idolatry, they say, and let's take a look at what they say to Aaron. If you turn to page 495, it's
So they're gathering around, the people gathered around Aaron and said to him, and let's pick it up there. Beth Ann, do you want to pick it up the rest of the sentence on top of 495?
From Rise Up?
Yes.
Rise up, make for us gods that will go before us. For this man Moses, who brought us up from Egypt, we do not know what became of him.
Okay. So when it says rise up, make for us gods, first of all, it's weird because they're already talking not about one. They're talking about plural. And what it says, Aselanu Elohim, Asher Yelchu, just so that we know, Yelchu is the plural tense. It's not, because we say Eloheinu when we talk about God in the singular, but Elohim is plural, and Yelchu means, and they will go. Elohim, that name is the name of power. Okay, so when we talk about that name of God, is God as the creator is called Elohim, which is why in Bereshit, in Genesis, it starts out, Bereshit bara Elohim. In the beginning, God created heaven and earth. That wasn't, we don't say Ein Sof. We don't say the source of all things created, because we don't know anything. We can't say anything about that. We say Elohim, that aspect of God that we experience as creator. That is what created us. And what the Jewish people wanted here is that they wanted some sort of creative force to be created that would have power, because Elohim is about power. We need a power that's going to walk before us and help us, because we don't see Moshe. We've lost our connection to this Ein Sof. We're now going to... Let's just work with the paper here, because we don't see this anymore. We lost sight of our connection. And it says that this was a big problem, because the Jewish people had almost, what was the real problem? They had turned Moshe into an idol. That was the real problem. If Moshe leaves and all of a sudden you feel that you don't have a connection with God, that Moshe was your, in a way, your power, they were replacing Moshe with this golden calf. They weren't replacing God. They were replacing Moshe, who they saw as their power, because they had started to idolize him.
It's like Jesus.
It was very dangerous. He said that this almost had to happen to save the Jewish people, to put things in the proper perspective. Mm-hmm. It's also why we don't know where Moshe is buried, lest it become a shrine. It's like he is a conduit. He is not God. He is not a power of God. He is not a source. He is a conduit. And that the people misunderstood that. It says that all idolatry was the effort of human beings to deal with the paper covers over the book, to identify what were the Elohims, what were the powers in the universe that they needed to have function in this particular way, and they did not see at the core the Ein Sof, that God is the ultimate source. We address this. Every blessing we make, we are affirming this relationship. And even though none of us may have ever given this one thought, every time we make a blessing, we are saying that. We say, Baruch Atah, blessed are you, Adonai, which is the Yud Heh Vav Heh name, Eloheinu, our power source, Melech HaOlam, ruler, crown sovereign of the universe. And then I'll say the blessing that over a glass of water. Shehakol nihia bidvaro, through whom all things are created, through not your word, his word. Now what's the difference? I went from the second person to the third person. Second person is you, third person is he. By third person, I'm saying it's all actually coming from the aspect of God that I have no direct relationship with, but I know you're the book underneath the whole thing. I see the paper, and I see the projection, and I just received this glass of water. So what I'm saying is, God, I know this came from you. You want to relate to me as a creator, and you want to relate to me as my parent, as my lover, as my friend, and you want to give me everything because you've said you want to be involved with me and to be in relationship, so you gave me this water. But I know that it came from a source that is higher, from that which I cannot call you, because I don't have a you. I have a third person aspect that is the source of everything, and I want you to continue that relationship and continue bringing these things into the world. So that's what we're saying every time we say a blessing. which is really pretty weird. Okay, so Judaism's concept of God is actually pretty complex and pretty sophisticated. So we're saying there's an aspect that we cannot know, but we know it's there even though we cannot know it directly. We see it indirectly through all of the things that exist in the world. Idolatry was a normal response. I see the things in the world. It makes sense for me to address my requests to the powers that I see. But the powers that they saw were the draping over the book, rather than seeing the source of it inside. That was the sin, saying, you're not in relationship with me. If you saw somebody who went up to a movie screen, and let's say it didn't disappear, because if you stand in front of a screen, it disappears. But let's say you're like, have a hologram concept, which is really a Star Trek idea. And you went up and you saw somebody, you know, kissing something that was the likeness of you but wasn't you, but you were married to this person. You would say, hey, wait, that's not me. Why are you relating to that which is not me? I'm the world I'm projecting into this world for you to use and to be involved with, but if you don't know that the source is me, we can't be in relationship. You need to know it's me. And says that's the sin of idolatry, is because it's not reality and it's not the real relationship. And that is why it was punished so severely. So he said that every sin that we commit has a smidge of the golden calf in it. It says because all the mistakes that we make in our life when we do the wrong thing is because we've made some mistake in perception of true reality. And if we understood and really perceived true reality, we would be less likely to make the mistakes. So every sin has a little bit of the golden calf. So the Jewish people make this mistake, and in a way, it also saves them. Thank God, God works in mysterious ways, and our errors become also our transformation. Because then the Jewish people saw Moshe is not God. He is representing God. He is not God. We don't pray to Moshe. We don't worship Moshe. We call him Moshe our teacher, not Moshe the demigod. Okay, so the people had made him into a demigod, which is why they wanted to replace him and his power and his strength when they thought he wasn't there. So it was actually a reality check that was, thank God for it, and hopefully a lesson for all of us. So it's a little strange to go out and look at the world and say, this is all a projection. It's a little bit Plato-like of, you know, it's like all a dream or something. It's like, is the image real? It's like, the things we see are the least real part of reality. The most real part of reality is the spiritual energy that is making it all happen. So when we say that if God withdrew God's will, that all of creation exists, everything would revert to complete nothingness. So it is a projection that is being constantly projected. If we see a projection that we don't like and that we're unhappy with, we don't start messing around with the sheets. Go to the source. So that's when we address ourselves, the human beings, as the created ones. We are partners. God gave us a partner in Shabbos to reflect on what that relationship is all about. Hopefully we'll be able, la'asot et ha-shabbat, to make our Shabbos and to take each week the opportunities to make it new, to make it fresh, to make it rejuvenating, to make it spiritual, to learn more about ourselves, who we are, and what we're doing here. It really would take more than 25 hours to go through that whole experience. Hopefully we can just squeeze out a little bit more and add to that day to make it the richest day possible. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Have a wonderful Purim Katan. And look at the world as the projected world it is, and know that there is a tremendous hand behind everything that we know is there. It's Shabbos. Sure. The truth is, you could go onto the Art Scroll website. Anything there I would like and I would put by in my library. My library, I have quite a library. And I developed that only from the one decision of not reading the newspaper on Saturdays. I thought, I am not reading this, so what am I going to read? I'm like, oh, well, I don't even have enough room for all my books. Anything by Sarah Yocheved Riegler? Anything by Rebbetzin Heller? Sephora Heller? I'll make up a list of things that I have that are good.
I have to go to Jerry Green. Yes.
Rigler, R-I-G-L-E-R. Sarah Yocheved Rigler. Oh, that's a book exchange. Like, I read this. Or even a book list, because people like to have them. It's like, they're like my children.